Hey, everybody. Welcome to an unexpected podcast. This is Matt in Boston, Evan about 10 feet away from me, and Rainier in Honduras.
I'd say probably 12.
Maybe 12. We're also going to be joined by Devin in a few minutes. He is being fashionably late. So we're going to go through a list, as we always do. This is a list. Evan tells me this is the second list we have done for Giraffe Deity, but since Giraffe Deity has won the award of best screen name ever, I think we can do two lists from him. So we're going to do a list review for Giraffe Deity. We are going, Devin will, when he arrives, talk a little bit about Nova, because Nova tickets dropped and it's sold out in about 30 seconds. He's going to tell us a little bit about how it's going to be run this year, because it's going to be a little different. And then we are going to be talking about cavalry armies, what they're good for, what they're not good for, their pros, their cons, and strategies for using them. So with that said, let's go in and talk about Giraffe Deity's list. And there it is in all its glory. So
recommend screen sharing, Dad.
Oh, I always forget to hit the share button. There we go. There it is in all its glory. Okay. So Giraffe Deity's list. He has a Mordor list. He's taking to a 700 point tournament in March. This is a very unusual list. I think there's a lot to talk about here. Warband One, which is the leader, is the Dwemer Lake on foot. With him are six orcs with shield, five orcs with spear, one orc banner with shield and spear, and a Mordor troll. And with that, he has Warband 2, the Mouth of Sauron on armored horse, five orcs with shield, four orcs with spear, Grishnak, and four orc. Then the next Warband 3, is Grishnak, four orcs with two-handed axe, not something we see very often, four orcs with spear. And then Warband 4 is a black Numenorean marshal with horse, or on horse with lance, two Morgul knights, and two orc trackers on warg. So in the description here, he says he's trying to give the Dwemer Lake lots of opportunities to use his special rule. Each of these warbands has a threat that opponents will want to use might or will to counter, and the wraiths can be placed nearby to drain those resources. I know the Dwemer Lake is a poor leader, but the mouth isn't much better, and the wraith can hide behind my orcs and do his job. Looking forward to this episode. So, thoughts. Rainier, why don't you start?
I think it's interesting. I'm glad that the Giraffe Deity said he wanted to use a theme of underused models, because at first we were kind of perplexed at the decision of all of this. It is kind of interesting, because I don't know too much about the Dwemer Lake, but Mouth of Sauron's pretty good at 700 points. Grishnak can be a good underused model with three might. Black Numenorean Marshal with a lance could do some killing power, but I think I don't know if it was a competitive list. I don't know if it would be that competitive, I guess, because most of the killing power does come from the Mortar Troll, which can be subdued easily by magic or like a quick like sacrifice model to stop it from doing much. So yeah, I don't know. I'm curious what you guys think. I also see some two-handed axes, and I would never bring two-handed axes, but Giraffe Deity, like, you are the deity of the giraffe, so I respect it. We'll see what everyone else says.
All right. Yeah. Evan, what are your thoughts here?
So Giraffe Deity here, his original intention was he was cooking pasta, right? So Giraffe Deity came over here, he was cooking pasta, and then he's like, maybe I'm going to add some ketchup to that pasta. And it's like, all right, okay, well, that's a little bit unusual, but I think it'll still make a dish. The issue then, Giraffe Deity, is that he kept going. He threw some dirt in there. He threw some of his some grass in there as well. He threw all sorts of different things in there, and it ended up with a completely inedible product. And I think this list pretty much exemplifies that, which is he wanted to take some unique models that aren't often seen, and he wanted to use them in a list. And the issue is, when you do that, you usually want to make a list with a bunch of good models that can capitalize on these unique models' traits. However, this list includes a vast number of models that A, don't work well together, and B, are not particularly powerful. The Mouth of Sauron's all right. The Dwemer Lake is not. The Mordor Troll is not. The Black Numenorean Marshal is functional, but definitely not at the top of what you want to take in a Mordor list. And Grishnak, you generally prefer to take Gorbag over him or any of the other orc heroes. So I think this list is the result of trying to amalgamate a bunch of models that aren't that great. And unfortunately, I think it shows. And there's a couple of ways I might change this list, but they generally all revolve around making the models that aren't the Dwemer Lake, which I assume is the model that he would like to keep in this list the most, because that's what he wanted to make it around. And it's beefing up the heroes and the troops around it. So first things first, I would almost immediately drop the Mordor Troll. And I think my other two co-hosts would probably agree with me on that front. And then I would try and incorporate some other model that can do the hitting power much more reliably than the Mordor Troll. So perhaps I would change maybe the Black Numenorean Marshal or Grishnak or something like that, and maybe take something big, like a Witch King on Fel Beast or some other Ringwraith on Fel Beast that offers a huge threat that then draws the opponent's might and will points that the Dwemer Lake can then go and support on his own, and provide the might draining effects and the will draining effects that you want to use. Because I feel like the Dwemer Lake is someone that can benefit a lot from other casters around him draining the will points of other models. And seeing as the only other caster he really has is the Mouth of Sauron, who is not very reliable and can't cast a lot of spells, I think something like a big scary Witch King on Fel Beast could be useful. The issue, though, actually, no, I don't think it's an issue, because if you drop Mordor Troll and Black Numenorean Marshal on Horse with Lance, that'll give you, what, like 180, 190 points, something like that?
Yeah, then you could just take the Black Numenorean's warband and put it with the Witch King, because his warband could be pretty big.
Yeah, yeah.
I do like what you're saying, though, Evan, because it is the triple threat caster would be really cool, but also it is like it's not quite a horde. If you went for the semi-horde route, all of your models are orcs and they die really quickly. And then if you want to distribute all of your hitting power, which people typically do at seven, well, not typically, but they sometimes do at 700 points, your heroes aren't, I guess, good enough to spread out. Like each one would still die to a Hurin or a Boromir or a Faramir or an Aragorn. So it's not really, it's kind of like a spread out army, but like none of the places are really a strength. Yeah,
That sort of touches on another issue, which is that for having just normal orcs, this army is quite small. 38 models and just having an orc horde, unless you have some really big heroes, which you don't, isn't really going to cut it. Sorry, Rainier, what were you going
to
say?
No, I think I agree with you. I think we're both heading in the same direction, and it is too not much might for that as well. So I do agree with Evan, like go big on something. If it's like the Witch King instead of Black Numenorean and Troll, you got three casters and that'll shut down most of anything, plus give you a really scary model that's flying that has might and will and like casting, which is the Witch King. That's a lot scarier than the Troll. It's kind of like, but I guess you do want to use underused models. I see where you're going, but yeah, I don't know. I think we're coming from a competitive standpoint. And that's why we're making, I guess, these critiques and stuff. But yeah, for me, the main issue is just that there's nothing that puts you above in any department when it comes to models, might, magic, or like heroes.
Yeah. So I do have to say, I do like the concept of trying to find something useful for the Dwemer League to do. That's a really tough ask. The only time I've ever really used him and been like, oh, that worked pretty well, was when I threw him in an Angmar list with a Shade. And a Shade and a bunch of Terra-causing models. But, you know, I do actually kind of like the combination of a Dwemer Lake and a Troll, because a Troll is something that your opponents have to strike up against, which is not usually something you have if you're fighting good, right? Because good usually has a fight advantage on most everything you're going to fight, but not a Mordor Troll. So I think that was the theory there. You know, Well, I'll talk in a second about some alternatives to the Dwemer Lake, but if you want the Dwemer Lake in there to try and make him work, I wonder if the way to do it is drop Grishnak, drop the Mordor Troll, and bring a Mordor Troll Chieftain. Because, oh boy, is that somebody you have to strike up against. And if, you know, if the Dwemer Lake is just kind of like following the, you know, it's like the Dwemer Lake, the Mordor Troll Chieftain is the big bully, and the Dwemer Lake is the big bully's little friend that just kind of like follows him around and goes, yeah, get him. Get him, guy. you know, that I think is, yeah, that I think would be a fun combination, because, you know, people are going to be trying to like cast spells at the Mordor Troll Chieftain to try and transfix him and have to spend extra will for that. They're going to be trying to strike up against the Troll Chieftain and have to spend extra will for that. And the Mordor Troll Chieftain is going to stick around, I think, a little longer than the Mordor Troll. So I think that's the way I'd go. That doesn't necessarily solve your numbers problem here. And the fact that, you know, what you have are 30 something orcs backing up this Mordor Troll Chieftain. And, you know, I'm not sure entirely what the solution is to that. One might be to drop both Mortal Knights and get some Black Numenoreans to get more of like a foot terror wall, and then just have, and fight for a foot terror wall and have some orcs with shield behind them. And maybe hope that the Dwemer Lake will suck some will out of some heroes that like fail their terror test to charge. That might be a way to go. I mean, I think if you want to stick to the underused model theme, I wonder if the better option for the ring raid that leads this band is not the Dwemer Lake, but the Undying. You know, as a guy who just, I mean, obviously you don't get the Might, Will, and Fate sync, but you get, you know, what, like 18 points of will that just kind of, and he just walks around behind the line casting spells. He does get two might to add into this, so he can spend his might on stuff. You know, whether you do that, you drop the troll and you just drop and get rid of the troll and then put a whole bunch of Black Numenoreans in front of this. That might be a way to go too. If you're limited on, you know, if you've got a figure capability thing here, and what you've got are a bunch of orcs, and you've got like a troll model, I'd call that Dwemer Lake. Yeah, well, okay. The Dwemer Lake can be the Dwemer Lake. I would call that Mordor Troll Chieftain. And then I would figure out how to just get either some more orcs or some Morannans, or hopefully some Black Numenoreans that can stand in front and be a terror wall. And maybe getting rid of a couple of Mortal Knights are a way to do that. Maybe what you do is you drop the Black Numenorean Marshal and the Mordor Troll and turn those two into a Troll Chieftain, and then that leaves a bunch of points left over. You know, that may be the way to go. I mean, there's some other things you can do here. It's not clear to me you need a banner in this list, since you're only fight three. So if you really want to get some points to get some more figures in this, drop the banner. I don't think I would spend the points on the two-handed axes. So, I mean, I think So I guess option one here is change Dwemer Lake for Undying. Option two is delete the Mordor Troll and one of the other leaders and throw a Mordor Troll chieftain in here to have the Dwemer Lake follow him around. And option three is, you know, just drop something and get more figures in here one way or the other, or tougher figures.
I think definitely the like immediate go-to I would say for this list, and I think all of us will agree with, is to get something in there that isn't just basic orcs. And I think the answer is Black Numenoreans, because of how well they synergize with the Dwemer Lake, because he can make people fail courage tests and he's got the minus one aura as well. So that's the first thing I think I would do, is if you have Black Numenoreans, you know, however many you have that can make a front line, throw them in there. And that will help your list a lot. And if you need to drop the banner to do that, so be it. And then it seems like the next step is to drop the Mordor Troll and a hero, and then either take something like the Witch King or a Mordor Troll Chieftain or something of that ilk, in order to get you some more reliable hitting power with might. And I think if you make those changes, you're already sort of getting to a much, much stronger list that will still give you the Dwemer Lake and some other cool options you've got, but also just like be reliable.
Devin, you got any thoughts on this? We got a list with a Dwemer Lake in it. We don't get those very often.
Yeah, obviously, I haven't played the Dwemer Lake at all in the new edition, and the 6-inch range on what essentially is a model that doesn't want to be anywhere near your opponent's heroes is pretty bad. So the only like kind of weird combo I ever thought of was like throwing him in with somehow Grima or something. And obviously this is way, for me to rehash kind of what you've already said about the list is, you know, yeah. I mean, if you're going to stay within the confines of this list, I'm not against throwing in Black Numenoreans and such. Like, I mean, it makes sense, Harbinger, but then you could get really any Wraith to do that. So then we're just saying like, all right, it's a cool gimmick that he adds on to that, that if someone happens to be in range of both him and also is trying to charge in, because they only lose that will or have to like use will to pass a courage test, which, you know, arguable that a hero would ever really have that problem. But if they have to do it, it's at the point of which they start the charge, which is probably 6 inches or so from the model. I mean, that's an initial charge. So maybe turn after turn. Sure. You know, it works. I mean, I haven't put a lot of thought into making the Dwemer Lake work, so I'm not going to be able to add a lot to it, because I'm just like, they just neutered him so much that it's pretty tough.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have to say, I do like the idea of a Dwemer Lake following around a troll or some sort of troll variant.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, that is in. People will spend resources. People can kill that troll, but they'll need to spend resources to do it. And they'll need to spend, you know, 1.5 times the number of resources they ordinarily would. You know,
and I think that's a great idea. I do like that, that at least now that an obvious heroic strike play is not the answer. Well,
yeah,
it's the answer, but a harder choice.
So, you know, if you're going to take the Dwemer Lake and if you're going to make the Dwemer Lake your leader, you need to be going to a veto system tournament, because you do not want to end up playing Contest of Champions with the Dwemer Lake as your leader. That's not going to end well. Although, unfortunately, if you take the Mordor Troll Chieftain, you can't make him the leader over the Dwemer Lake, because the Mordor Troll Chieftain is a hero of fortitude. But what you can do is you can put the Dwemer Lake, you know, you put the Dwemer Lake down with his warband up there, and then leave like a Mordor Troll Chieftain base size hole right in front of him. Because, you know, he needs to be within 3 inches of the center, but that's enough to fit a Mordor Troll Chieftain thing in. And you leave that space, and then you let your opponent deploy his warband, and then you go and you deploy the Mordor Troll Chieftain next, and you just plop that Mordor Troll Chieftain right down in front of him and watch watch the eyes of the other guy's general kind of go wide. But that would be a fun experience. At least it gives you something to do.
So I'll have to test out some lists with trying to make the Dwemerlake work. I haven't put enough thought to be able to give meaningful criticism.
Yeah. So Dwemerlake with a shade is actually kind of scary.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Since the shade does force you to spend might.
Yeah, the shade forces you to spend might, and then you've
Or a
got
shade,
minus one. And in that Angmar list, it gives you a terror wall with ordinary orcs because you've got enough dudes. And the Dwemerlake sitting, near a shade with a line in front of him, and then like a Barrow-wight sitting next to him that's like throwing paralyzes at that people have to show to like double the amount of will to try and resist the paralyzes is kind of frightening. You just have to have a th you have need to have a thick enough wall of orcs to stand in front of all this, because you're not going to have any might to do anything with if you have that type of list. So no heroic moves for you. So all right. Any last thoughts on Giraffe Deity's list here? Or not, we'll move on. So Giraffe Deity, let us know how this goes. If you end up taking the Dwemerlake, we'd love to know how he performs. So
Yeah.
So always unfortunate when we can't give a ton on that. Well, I mean, I know you'd have it definitely did, but I don't know. Did Rainier comment on it? I actually came in after, I guess.
I did. We just talked about, I guess, like how there's it's interesting, but there's no strengths that would push it over the edge. Like it's not a horde army, it's not a like well-rounded like hero list or anything like that. But I'm curious, watch him more in the tournament. I'm rooting for you, Draft Deity.
Any list with a Dwemerlake in it, is definitely going to be the underdog list and get a lot of likes for that.
But the shade was it. I'm actually looking back, I'm surprised none of us mentioned the drum. The drum might have been an interesting thing.
Oh, adding a drum to this?
Yeah.
Why? You mean just to speed the list up? There's not
Yeah.
yet. Oh, there was a march. There was the marshal in there.
That's
Yeah, the
true.
marshal's got to march, and I don't think you can spend any more points on things that aren't figures in this list.
Without getting
Yeah.
rid of the troll.
Yeah. All right. So what do we got next? We got Nova.
So Devin's going to talk about Nova. Devin, talk about Nova.
All right. So Nova's a thing, and
Is it really? I've never heard of it, to be honest.
I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure. So I haven't looked at the numbers since it launched. As of we're filming this on the 5th of March, so this is like 5 days after launch, I believe. I believe I'm already sold out. I believe the GT is already sold out. That, or at least I know that they messaged me on Saturday, I believe, or something. No, on like Monday or something. They're 2 days later, and they said I only had two slots left in the GT. So it should be already sold out. If not, then hey, we probably have two slots. So it's gonna be a pretty packed event. Looking forward to it. I'm trying again to do four rounds. Last year we ended up,
Four
and I
rounds?
guess I'm sorry.
Four rounds?
Six. Sorry. Four rounds on a Saturday. So let me go through all the whole schedule, and then I'll hit new things that I'm throwing in there. We actually are adding a veto system, so that's a new little element to it, and kind of throwing some of the events. So, as many people know, the Nova Open moved to the hotel in DC, so it is no longer in the Hyatt Regency right next to the airport. It's actually in DC, in the middle of DC. The convention center is massive. I personally haven't been there yet, but it's extremely large. So we are actually, of course, in a main hall, sort of prominently displayed, since our terrain is kind of does that. And we'll see how that goes. Basically, as far as the events, I wanted to keep it as close as possible to last year because I didn't know how the new venue would throw things off on the schedule. And this is even beyond just players showing up and leaving. This is even like Nova's logistics are really well practiced at the Hyatt, but not so much at this location. So I don't know. I'm not really 100% sure how much time on a Sunday we're going to have. And for those who stuck around after 4 p.m. on Sunday, you've always noticed that Nova like packs up really fast. So I have never been able to get for the GT, three rounds on that Sunday. Everyone always asks, why don't you do three rounds on Sunday? I can't. Otherwise, like, and then that plus people have flights. So I want to get six rounds in. We're at 90 players now. We keep like kind of trickling it up. We could get more if I have the limit, but I don't have enough terrain for that. And so we're going to try again four on a Saturday. And before anyone panics, about four rounds in a Saturday. We do have hour-long breaks in between each round. There's plenty of space while starting like late enough to allow you to get some sleep for those of you who want to party all night, but also not ending at 10 p.m. It's not going to be like that. So we have a lot of time. And the way that I did that is I shrunk the points for the first time to 650. So we are actually in a 650-point tournament, which allows me to reduce the time because, as everyone knows, Nova is usually an 800-point tournament. So that's kind of like the major change on the GT that a lot of people may not be used to. So four rounds, plenty of break time. Any questions about that before I keep going on it?
Yeah, I'm interested. Have you gotten any pushback for the 650? I know a lot of events worldwide are going lower, but have you gotten pushback from like people at all?
So the only reason I think I haven't, or maybe haven't, is because as of the recording of this video, Alisher from the Philly group, so he messaged me today and said, "Hey, why is the Nova Open 2022 primer up and not the 2023?" And so I was like, "I don't know. Like, I don't upload anything to the site. I have no idea." So I think the only reason that I haven't heard anything is because no one knows. And you guys are actually the first ones to hear it for the
Oh,
first time
scandalous.
right now.
Everyone's like, oh, it's easy peasy, just like last time.
So basically, well, let's talk about it. 650. What are your guys' initial thoughts of hearing that?
Well, I'm curious, are you doing the veto system at all?
I am. Yep. So the veto system is going to be every single round, same way we did it at Alistair's. I will, for those who were not at Alistair's event, I will explain that in detail, but yes, short answer.
Okay, I like that though, because like with 650, if you get one of those like sucky ones, like Storm the Camp or something like that, like a lot of people are gonna be pissed if they if it's there's no like out. But like, yeah, I like it. 650. I was never, you probably look back at like old podcasts from the show. I was like, low points suck, don't do it, veto sucks, don't try it. But just like any gold of good American, I never actually tried it. But like having gone to Alistair's event, man, that was fun. Like a 650 point fast pace, you pick the scenario or like veto out the ones you don't want. I thought that was a blast, especially at Nova where the tables are gorgeous and beautiful, then people won't be like bickering or anything, being like, oh, like my Cav army didn't get blah 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 or whatever, too much terrain. I like the choice a lot. So it's gonna be really good, I think.
Yeah, I guess the only downside is it comes right after Articon, which is also 650.
Yeah.
So it's
Well, only for like the 10 Americans who go there, but
that's true.
they'll
Yeah,
get
well,
practice in
as being
the
one of those 10 Americans, it means I'm gonna be playing something on the order of like, within 2 weeks, I'm gonna be playing 23 650 point games. Quite possibly all with the same army. So
Well, at least I have saved you a lot of thinking time.
yeah, that's true.
A
Yep,
lot of painting.
that is true. Yeah, so all right. So that'll be interesting. 650 points. So
Is. Normally, we always go bigger. If I can get that. So, what I'm going to do for this year is I'm going to actually monitor how logistics go, how what's pack up time at the end of Nova and on that Sunday. And I'm also going to see how many people need to leave at the end of that. And then I'll kind of decide, can next year, can I just add that third round onto the Sunday? Because that would be the most ideal situation.
well, since the primer hasn't gone up yet, can I by any chance talk you into 700 points?
I mean, we could talk about it. I mean, honestly, it, yeah, I think as of right now, it still is not live. So I mean,
You would
now,
give draft, you would
I don't
give
think
draft
700
deity a
points
chance.
adds any time. It just makes it kind of like slightly different from Articon.
I mean, I've allotted two. The only thing I cannot change is the amount of time per round. And
Yeah, that's what I'm
so
saying.
I
So, I
have
mean,
2 hours.
yeah, so 700 points
Wait,
in a
each round
2 hour
is
round is
2 hours
fine.
and 1 hour 45.
No, each round is 2 hours. I gave plenty of time for a 650 point match.
Yeah, so 700 points for a 2 hour round is also fine.
Yeah,
if you wanted to do that,
it could be a consideration. I guess rather than make an on the cuff idea right now, what we'll do is, I guess you'll know once it actually uploads. I have to send it to him tonight
based off this conversation.
After this conversation right here, history is being made.
Yeah, you know what's going to happen. Tim Hickson, who's like the best editor I've never hired, is going to look at it and be like, why does it say in one place in the primer it's 650 and the other it's 700? And I'm like,
that's what find replaces for.
Lucky Tim Hickson has like enough armies to do whatever.
So to the extent my opinion matters, my vote is for 700, just because I think that is slightly, you know, if nothing else, it's just going to be slightly different than Articon. And 2 hour rounds, it is plenty of time for a 700 point game.
That is true, actually. That is true, especially when you veto it too. So everyone, not everyone, but you would typically think going into the round, they're not going to waste much time looking over the scenario because they chose it.
Mm. So, all right. Well, I'm not against it, and I think 2 hours is plenty for 700. Smaug being banned is already kind of in the primer, so it doesn't make any sense to 650, but it could at 700, right? All right. Well, then that's something that, yeah, that's not a problem at all. I mean, I could definitely consider that, and I guess we'll chat after, or maybe I'll just think about it after. But
also, I am curious how many people, what's the max limit? Because it is sold out.
Right? 90.
Wow, that's going to be a good event.
Yeah, I keep like trickling it up, but I won't let it go too, like, because obviously, if it sells out in less than a week, then it clearly could have more capacity. I'm just a little bit overwhelmed with the terrain to do that. I think what I'm going to do, so what I'm doing this year is I'm going to actually, I'm hiring people to help me. So I'm no longer doing it myself. So that should massively help with that. Not hiring people to help me ship it. So I always have people who want to help set it up. The setting up part's actually kind of a tough thing because I need people who like know the boards very well. So people who've played on it. So you guys would be perfect. But you all on this podcast rarely show up like on those days. But well, except for, I guess, Matt, you do show up on the Thursdays.
Yeah, sometimes I'll show up on the Thursdays. I think we were planning on coming down the Thursday night.
Okay. So, yeah, that would be a little rough for you. And I have to have it set up by then. See, whoever helps me has to show up on Wednesday.
Yeah.
So basically, I don't have too many people except for the locals who can do that. We'll see about future events if we want to kind of go past that. But what I'm going to do this year is make it even more abundantly clear that there will be boards for anyone who has like Mummix, all Cav armies, and you end up on Lake Town. Like, hey, you know, you can possibly swap the board if you physically cannot play. That's one. Apparently, there was one person who had a criticism last year who my only assumption is they brought Mummix or Ironheart Chariots or something, and they were on a board where their model could not move. It wasn't even a matter of just disadvantage. It was like the model could not move. And I'm pretty sure last year I announced that, hey, you can swap the board. Make it very clear. You can swap your board in an event that it's like an auto loss as a result of the board. Like true auto loss, not like I'm at a little disadvantage, like a real auto loss.
This has two pieces of tree terrain. I don't think I can play this because you guys are elves. This is unfair.
Yeah.
So I really like the idea of the Moic friendly board, and now I'm wondering if the Moic friendly board is going to be one of the ones that has like all the dead Moomax on it.
Actually, why not?
Your this is just so intimidating.
It's your future.
Yeah, that's right.
I wonder if anyone else played on Pelennor Fields with the Mummic army. That would be awesome.
that's the thing, Devin. Like, your boards are so cool. So it is like whoever made it out or got a ticket, like, good for you. That's going to be like a blast, the themes. I just have these flashbacks to my first Nova when I just got into the game and I was like, oh my gosh, I found Nerd Paradise.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to recreate every year. And actually, man, small side note, Alex Wright now no longer makes terrain. I need a new terrain maker, whoever is in America and wants to volunteer on the East Coast.
Yeah, so look, if you're a terrain maker and you're listening to this, go ahead and post in the comments because Devin's
In
got some
America,
business
on
for
the
you.
East Coast.
Yeah.
Shipping costs.
Well, I mean, once you get to shipping, does it really matter where you are? I mean, does it cost more to ship from the West Coast to you than it costs to ship from, like, Boston to
Well,
you?
I will actually entertain more elaborate boards if I can go and pick them up. Because I'll drive extensive distance. Like I drove to Canada to pick up boards routinely. The cost of shipping is actually much higher than we would have expected. Like Alex Wright had a board for me. I think it was like $800 to ship. It was like some stupid number. It was like something
Wow.
stupid. It was like maybe not 800. Maybe it's egregious. I need
I
him to
was
tell me what it was.
going to say, was this like a board made out of depleted uranium or something like
Yeah,
that?
it was multiple boxes. It was just a lot of boxes. And also there was one that George Nikitaitis from Canada, he couldn't ship it. He just said like that the price was so exorbitantly high, it just couldn't be shipped.
It was
I think it was
cheaper
just
just to build a second board for you in place.
yeah, basically.
Get him a plane ticket.
Yeah, that's right.
Because I think it was also the weight of the boards, like they were casting stuff out of resin, and like it was a whole bunch of different factors that just added to the just size, weight, and everything. And the only reason I'm like remembering it like this, I remember the 1 year, very first year of Nova. Anyone who ever attended that knows that we had weapons, like the one behind me. We had weapons that we gave to the first time winners. Last time I ever did that, because of course the GBHL won all of the weapons. Couldn't bring them on a plane, and I had to ship it over there. It was more expensive for me to ship the weapon I already owned than it was for me to buy a new one from New Zealand and have them ship it. So I had to buy all the weapon. This thing behind me right here is one of the prizes of the Nova Open first year.
That was poor
So
planning there.
it was extremely poor plan. So I know the shipping costs can get absurd if you don't have like regular contracts or something or frequent flyer shipping miles or whatever with them. So, yeah, East Coast is preferred because then I don't have to limit it to, all right, just build these Rohan houses. Now I can be like, yeah, go ahead and build me Rivendell, like the giant Rivendell. Yeah, I can build something a lot crazier. So, but yes, if you happen to not be on the East Coast, then we will limit it to, Rohan houses and the like. So yeah, I mean, other than that, we're gonna try something. The only thing we're gonna try new is on the Thursday. You'll notice, oh, well, no one has noticed. There are actually two Chaos and Ardor rounds. We're actually trying out a kind of a tournament version of it. I'm just kind of prototyping it and seeing how the cards work if in a 1v1 sort of format. It's a thought. Yeah, we were just like, all right, I'm not the first to think of this. Canada has done it, and they said they actually like doing it that way. So I was like, all right, we'll try two rounds and see how it goes and see how people feedback with it. So that's a thought with that. Other than that, nothing's changed. Doubles, I just keep it all the same. It's working. I entertained a team thing. I've decided just for this year, I'm not going to do it. But I think 1 year, I'm definitely going to entertain teams of three. And we could talk about that on this podcast here with you guys. Like, what do you guys think about that? If I did like three-man teams, I've even thought about 1 year at Nova just going totally wild and saying, all right, instead of even pairing up as individuals, maybe there's a tournament like sort of like the doubles, but it's like a triples. I don't know. Like, just trying to throw out new, or does everyone just want it to stay exactly the same? I mean, just keep it going.
I wonder if there's a way, because we talked about this, about the team concept where you have like the three people, like or however many people on the team, and it was teams versus teams. I'm wondering if there's a way
Yeah.
where you could have both teams and individuals in the same tournaments. So like in the preliminary rounds, like the individuals would play against individuals. And the teams would play against teams.
Could be
So,
interesting. Like the first round, when you say player.
well, yeah, or like, on Saturday you do that, right? And then
Yeah.
Sunday it's just everybody's an individual
That would
at
be
that point in
interesting
time.
because it would, I think, yeah, that would be really interesting. I think people would call foul though for like if like a really competitive team goes up against like a
It would definitely mess around with the rankings a
But
lot.
you
But
Swiss
it would be
pair
cool.
that too, right?
That's
So,
true. Like put like New England against like Philadelphia or like DC against
yeah.
Maryland or
And
something.
it may be, the simplest way is, of course, to do it the way Articon does it. Just simply don't play against your own teammates. End of story. But
Yeah, I don't know. I've always found that unsatisfactory, and I do like the idea. It, you don't actually feel like you're on a team, right? Because,
yeah.
I mean, that is one of the things where I've like been on teams at Articon is you don't feel like you're on the team. The reason you're on the team is just to avoid playing certain people. At least in my head, I mean, I know there are people who really get into it, but it's hard because you're not doing, because I've been to team wargaming tournaments, and it is fun when you like walk up to a bunch of tables and like you're all in your line next to each other, right? And you can turn to your teammate on the right and see, hey, how's it going? And your teammate on the left's like,
Yeah.
look, you need to carry me because I'm getting crushed here. And that really builds camaraderie, which the you're just with like four other people who you have no idea what's going on in the tournament are doing. Which is why I'm wondering whether maybe that team thing for like the first three or four rounds, where you have a bunch of Swiss paired individuals playing over there, and you have say you got like a dozen three man teams that signed up and they're playing on the other side, and they you Swiss pair them. So first round it's just random draw of team versus team, and after that it's top team versus second top team, third team versus third top team, and keep going that way.
I mean, you know what I would do with all these kind of elaborate ideas is probably host for the first time in a long time a non-Nova tournament, something outside of Nova, and then just try out these
Cool.
concepts. But like obviously on a much smaller scale with like 30 people, but just to see how that kind of how it even orchestrate that whole idea. But most likely because Nova is sort of, I don't know what many would consider it. The final GT of the year, I guess, some in some minds of some, maybe keeping it the simple way is that's why I'd keep just repeating the same thing and just recreating new
It's
terrain
just
to may vary it up.
a nice, simple 90-person tournament.
Yep.
Yep.
And so that's it. I mean, long breaks in between and try to give, I think there's not a single break that's less than an hour. So it's like, it's a, you have a lot of time to shop. To enjoy the event at Nova, just kind of like walk around, do things. A lot of people always ask me about the GW staff coming. And so to answer that up front, we never know until right around June or July. We never know. Actually, in previous years, we've always put the Middle Earth seminar. So I have to have the primer due in like December before the, that March where they open sales. So I have to put the Middle Earth seminar on there as a guess. I have no idea what, I just have to like block the time slot out.
Middle or seminar? Question mark.
Yeah. And it did happen where I had to cancel it 1 year because I couldn't get them over. As for this year, once again, I've asked. There is no, there's really no like, and I wish this was one of those moments of like, I know, but I can't say anything. Like, I really have no idea.
I mean, you could say
I could. And I guess
that.
technically, if I said that, it'd just because I'm legally obligated to some
Yeah.
somewhere, but it really is a matter of I have no idea. But yeah, no, I mean, if we get the Middle Earth team there, which everyone knows, I try really hard to do that every single year, then, we'll try to get a seminar. If we can't, then it'll be like last year where you saw, Jay. Just, judging, helping us out. I know Adam's done that a couple of years in a row. And then as far as I mean, that's kind of it for the Middle Earth side. I mean, it's either we have a seminar or we don't. And yeah, that's, I mean, honestly, Nova's so sweet and simple at this point. We've got it down to an art and a science that I hesitate to change it. Everyone who remembers Nova year one and two, or Rainier's year, his first year of Nova, where I disappointed this kid I just met.
You really know I went on the warpath for you.
You did.
It's okay, Devin. Water under the bridge. Water under the
Me
bridge.
and Adam Troke were like, we've just ruined this guy's year.
Yeah, and Rhaenyra was like, that's fine. Revenge is the dish best served cold.
Not
He's
now.
still biding his time.
I'm waiting. I'm like going into hibernation in like these different countries, and I'm testing out weird things on random
Yeah.
people, on Korean players, on Frontier players. I'm playing in a cave with a shaman. Like, it's just all these different things till I come back. And then, like, all of this knowledge that I got from the world, I come back and I play Goblin Town.
Yeah. Well, now,
I
to tell
think.
you the truth, Devin, the only reason you are still breathing is because you, Rhaenyra, and Adam Troke have not yet been in the same room again.
Yeah, there you go. That's the
Because,
spot.
he
We
has to
were,
take you
though,
both out.
at Articon, weren't we?
Yeah, I guess at Articon we would have all been in the same room. And just for clarity, because everyone who has no idea of the relationship between me and Rhaenyra is like, what the hell are they talking about? Very, very quick synopsis of it. Rhaenyra, first year at Nova, and this rarely happens, by the way. We are really, really on this, but the scorekeeper swapped his score and the opponent's score on, like, what
Yeah.
was the second round?
I think it was the third round,
Third
actually.
round. They swapped
Yeah.
the two scores in the scoring sheet. Now, normally, most players know that if you win a game, your numbers should decrease. And if you lose a game, your table numbers should increase. So
Yeah,
you
but this
know
was like the
something's wrong
first
if you
time I've ever played
massively.
the game. So I was like, I have no idea. I'm going, they're gonna send me to this
Exactly.
table, that table.
That's exactly it. Rainier, spot on. He was new. It's his first time. So of course he went to like table from table 20 to table 45 and was like, yep, this sounds about
Yeah,
right.
but
But it is because I lost. I think I lost my first round like 5-2, and then I went to win 12-0 the following four games. And I was like, "Hey, shouldn't I get third place?" And you guys were like, "No, you can't." And I was like,
Yeah,
"Okay."
it was a bad year. So that's what happened. But and that's that kind of score thing. We've gotten better and better at making sure no mistakes happen. To now, we have dedicated scorekeepers who do not move, and their whole job is just don't distract on anything other than scores. Hell, now we have Best Coast pairings. You basically enter your own scores at this point. We're keeping it simple. At this point, we've had so few hiccups. Last year, we introduced the Best Coast Pairings app as a new scoring technique. That was a new variable. This year, if we introduce something new, it's probably going to be the veto system. That's going to be our first major, my first major, major test of it, other than Alistair's tournament. But I know Matt has had a lot of experience with it and all that. So it probably will be just fine. And we'll see how that goes. So, but that's it. I mean, I wish I could come up with a whole bunch of other news, but I mean, Nova is pretty sweet and simple. It is just a premier tournament for a mass audience and a whole lot of fun stuff to do during a whole weekend.
All right.
Sounds like fun.
Looking forward to it. Should we talk about cavalry?
Yeah,
Let's
actually.
looking
Really.
forward to that too. So the kind of the discussion topic for this week was cavalry armies and what are they good at? What are they bad at? How do you use them? And I think the focus of the discussion is not necessarily going to be on cavalry in general. So we're not talking here about like, your Minas Tirith shield wall that has like, three or four knights running around, on its flank somewhere, but in all cavalry armies. So they're small number of these that are out there. Obviously,
Small number
Rohan
of
has.
competitive ones.
Well, there's a small number of ones, period, in relation. This is a small fraction of armies in total. And,
We when you say small frat, are you saying the whole army has to be all cav like Rohan for the most part, or is
yeah,
it like
or
I think
all
like
cav, or at least all
cav
mounted
themed
in some way.
like lists, like not like a Gondorian list with like five knights of Minas Tirith or something. Like we're
No. Well,
talking.
what I mean is like, for example, Mahud are not considered an all cav list, but could be played in an all cav format.
Well, yeah. So, yeah, we're not talking about lists that I mean, the same is true of Rohan, right? I mean, you don't have to play Rohan as all cavalry, but it's something that can be played as all cavalry. And because that's not every list. I mean,
so Rivendell, open to discussion since once again, it has one cap exactly. unit, but
we're talking about lists that, you know, people have, or at least have considered taking on the table that just don't have infantry in them. Let's define it that way.
Okay.
Or, you know, perhaps have like the token infantry in them. But so it's a small basket, right? I mean, Rivendell is one that has that option because you can get the Elrond and the Rivendell Knights. Rohan obviously has a number of different options because you can, you know, you can do Rohan, and then there's, you know, like about a dozen legendary legions that you can take that have that variant. You know, Mahud is another one because you can get, you know, like I'm going to get all camels. Khand is another one because I think, you know, chariots count as mounted too. There are some other ones that you don't typically see as all mounted, but you could do as all mounted. So, you know, you could do a Harad all mounted. There's, you know, you could do an Easterlings all mounted.
Easterlings?
Yeah, you can.
With Khand maybe? The pure Easterlings? Oh,
I've seen the tin drum like just get up in your face, and it's very interesting actually.
Yeah, I mean, theoretically you can do like an all cataphract, cataphract with Amder and, you know, mounted captains and stuff like that.
I have yet to see an all cav Eastwing army. My whole time in playing this game, I've seen people do all warg trackers.
Well,
I've seen some bizarre crap.
Yeah.
I've never seen that though.
Well, look, I mean, it's kind of like the Higgs boson, right? You know, nobody's ever seen one, but it's been theorized.
Yeah. It's like Bigfoot. We know it's there, but we ain't never seen it.
Yeah. But look, so before we get into this, you know, cause it, I mean, I think if we start talking about individual lists, we'll go down that rabbit hole and we'll never come out. But before we do that, I just wanted to kind of talk through what are the pros and cons of an all mounted army. So why don't we go around the horn and each kind of talk about, you know, a pro and a con of an all mounted army. And I mean, I'll start with the obvious one, right? Which is mobility. That, you know, cavalry moves 10 inches, foot moves 6. So cavalry can go farther. And if you're, you know, if you've got some sort of drum or marchability, you're adding 5 inches on instead of 3 inches on. And that mobility gives you a bunch of different options, right? You can close very quickly. So you can close that gap between your army and their army and get shot less when you're doing it. You can reposition very quickly. So you can take your army and pretend you're threatening the left flank, and then all of a sudden in one turn just switch around and you're threatening the right flank. And so if one guy's, you know, if you've got your army of dwarves and they put like all your heroes on the right because that's where your cavalry's going, and you're like, okay, now I'm gone, and you go over to the other side and attack the left flank, and the dwarven heroes are like, great, now I'm 3 turns out of position. That is another advantage. That is one advantage of a cav army. So I'm gonna start off with mobility. So Rainier, what's an advantage of a cav army?
I was gonna say the exact same thing, to be honest.
Come up with a different one then.
It's kind of a beginner's guide to cav armies.
Yeah,
you have to go advanced.
Okay, I'll go advanced. One good thing about cav armies are the heroes. So heroes make a cav army, in my opinion, really, really dangerous. If you have a flank of just cav, like for example, let's take Khand for an example, just Khand like on the flank, you have like 8 of them coming at you. That's all great and dandy, but like you can like counter that really easy with like a fight 5 hero, or you can counter it with a heroic combat or something like that. So I think one of the greatest strengths for cav are the ability to have heroes mounted and heroes leading them, because it makes those hits just that much powerful through heroic combats. So yeah, heroes.
All right, Devin, what's another advantage to an all cavalry army?
So I guess to stay in slightly more advanced, the psychological aspect of the fact that your opponent or you move so fast actually dictates a lot of your opponent's movements. Your opponent is going to be a lot less likely to either send out like scout units somewhere else or split their army up, that it like kind of piece it out into different areas to hold different points, mostly because your army is fast enough to just go redeploy entirely to go crush that point. That kind of feeds into what Matt was saying, but I think what Matt was kind of getting at on the redeployment part wasn't the piecemealing of an army, but so much as if you're struggling in one area, you can reinforce, or, you know, you can kind of pivot when you need to. This is pivoting, but more so without even having done that at all in the game, your opponent has to consider it. And there's a lot of missions where, you know, you'll find your opponent is not making certain actions because of the threat that your cavalry poses to, you know, piecemeal their army and crush a flank before, you know, he even gets react. So I think that it's sort of like a siege weapon. The actual damage from the siege weapon is not as important as the fact that it's making them spread out all over the place. Yeah. So it kind of like that. So I find that people do react to all cav armies very differently. So yeah.
So that's true. So, I mean, I'll name another obvious one, and it's one that's probably sufficiently obvious that kind of goes without saying, but we should say it. And that's hitting power, right? You know, one for one, a cavalry figure will trample an infantry figure into the dust, usually. And the reasons for that are the ones that are in the rules. When cavalry charges, it gets an extra die, so it's rolling two dice to the infantry's one. If it wins, it knocks that infantry on the ground, and instead of rolling two dice to wound, it's rolling four dice to wound. And on top of that, cavalry often comes with additional bells and whistles, like, you know, either a higher fight value because they're supposed to be elite troops, so they win ties, or lances, so they get the plus one to wound after they've trampled the guy into the dust and are rolling four dice. So in a one for one situation, and, you know, I'm going to put that caveat in there because we're going to talk about that later when we get to weaknesses of cavalry armies. In a one-on-one situation, a cavalry figure will generally kill an infantry figure. So if you can control the initiative sufficiently to get in so that one of your cavalry figures, say it's one of his infantry figures, you know, on a charge, you can do a lot of damage. And this couples with mobility, because one of the things a cavalry army can do is, because of the increased mobility, it can wrap around the flank of a shield wall in the way infantry can't. And it's actually kind of interesting to think about how, you know, this particular set of war games rules that, you know, we play with elves and dwarves and dragons and stuff like that, you know, and magic is, you know, everybody thinks of it, oh, this is a fantasy set of rules. It actually replicates historical tactics, small unit tactics, very well. And one of the ways it does this is with cavalry, because, and, you know, and oddly enough, by the way, it mimics Napoleonic cavalry better than it does, like, say, you know, ancient, like, Roman cavalry or medieval cavalry, where, you know, you had this charge with the knights that just kind of, like, bowled over the peasants. You know, the way Napoleonic cavalry would destroy infantry formations, because infantry always fought in lines because they were maximizing firepower, and Napoleonic cavalry would find the end of the line, run around behind it, and then hit the line from front and back at the same time. And that's the exact way that you can defeat a shield wall with a cavalry charge, is you hit the flank of that cavalry charge, or I'm sorry, the flank of that shield wall, and you have cavalry hit the guys in the front rank, and you have more cavalry spin around behind and hit the guys in the second rank, so that everybody's fighting one-on-one. You know, you're going to knock over all of your targets, so your targets are going to be trapped, and they can just kind of chew up that line from the end down. And that is, you know, that is a real historical tactic. Yeah, that is a real thing that cavalry did.
You're putting the fear into everyone's mind, Matt. Next tournament, you're going to see square formations.
Yeah, well, like, yeah, which, by the way, which, by the way, is a legitimate response to cavalry mm-hmm. in this game, is to form square. Yeah. I am not kidding you. That is a way to counter cavalry. But If you are a cavalry commander and you have that hitting power, you should be, and that mobility, you should be looking for the flanks of those shield walls to do the historical tactic of like wrapping around them. Because that really works. All right. So are there, before we talk about, kind of weaknesses of cavalry armies and cavalry figures, are there any more strengths we want to highlight here?
No, but I want to touch on what Devin said. The menacing look of a cav army really freaks people out. And I say this having played con,
They look a
like
lot larger than they are.
they do look a lot larger. Like even as a con player, like I've really spooked some people in the beginning of an event where I have like 20 defense for like horse archers. But they look terrifying, with like one or two chariots and they have the big banners and it really looks larger than what it is. And even playing against a lot of Rohan armies after the game or during the game, I realized, wow, like it's actually only like six cav on that flank and maybe four over there, but it looks really big and menacing. So I feel like paint jobs or the way you play it, you use that intimidation kind of to your favor.
Yeah, objects in cavalry armies may be larger than they actually appear. All right, Devin, any more thoughts before we go on to weaknesses of cavalry armies?
I mean, in order to give any more thoughts, you start to go with the caveat of like which armies have bows and how frustrating that is, mobility or magic, and their ability to kind of capitalize on that actually a lot better
Hit
than
and
infantry
run. Yeah,
has them.
so let's put a
So
pin in the bows because I think a better time to talk about the bows is after we talk about cavalry tactics.
okay.
So let's put
So
a
yeah,
pin
I
in the
was just
bow
saying
talk.
everything
Yeah.
else is like kind of an offshoot
All
of.
right. Okay, so let's go to weaknesses of cavalry armies because there are a number of them. So I guess I'll start again. And the first one is the one that's kind of in the front of the shop window, which is their cost, right? Cavalry is more expensive than infantry, and it's usually more expensive than infantry by like a factor of two. So in general, a cavalry army will be about half the size of a infantry army with the same points level. They have increased hitting power, but at the end of the day, it's still one figure. And if you're not charging it, that guy fights like one figure. This is why cavalry armies can often get reputations as glass cannons, because if they end up in a tactical situation where they need to kind of like fight one on one in a protracted, shoving match, they'll lose because there just aren't enough of them. All right, so cost, that's number one. So Rainier, what's another weakness of a cavalry army?
I think you already touched on it, but I do want to kind of mention it before I go into one, which is the shield wall. And I'm not just talking about the shield wall rule, but I'm saying like a two-man line, a cavalry army really, even if they kill the first rank, the counter charge can really like mess it up. So you have to like choose your tactics wisely and commit cav only when you know you can win. But I think one that I'm gonna throw out too will be monsters. Pearl can destroy cav lines. Fell beasts do really well against it. So like the idea of your cav, like Matt said, they're like 14 to 20 points. You have six or eight of them in like a little battle line or something, and a fell beast comes and like hurls and knocks them all to the floor.
They'll
Now they're just
gladly
like,
do it, even if their infantry is affected.
right, yeah. But
Yep.
then you have 7 point models instead of like 14 point models. So for me, that's one thing that I'm always like on the lookout for when I like see my opponents and I'm playing cav. Do they have a Golivar? Do they have Witch King? Do they have even trolls that can rogue combat or something? You have to keep that kind of in mind when playing against them. So that's a weakness.
Yeah, a Ringwraith on Fellbeast can ruin your whole day if you're running a cavalry army.
Yeah, it's
Devin,
magic.
what's the downside of a cavalry army?
I mean, the biggest one to me is just the base sizes.
Yeah, there you go.
I
Yep.
mean,
Talk about that.
There you go.
even the obvious, like I can put two infantry on one cav fairly easily, without a lot of ability support. The kind of less obvious one and expose when you play is if someone manages to get priority and you're already engaged, like let's say you engaged last turn and now you've all pushed off and now you're going again, you can end up trapping a lot of cav models behind the front line of cav models. And if you're not out in the open, like let's say you have trees on two sides or whatnot, you have terrain that's interacting, you can make it where like half of your army is just waiting their turn. And you know that causes a lot of problems because the base sizes are just huge. And you know the base sizes keep compounding on that because like if your opponent wants to do hero combats off of these very large base sizes, it's much easier. You get more models that bounce off and then create a lot more catastrophic effects. You know, they so and then that just keeps going further and further. Base sizes being larger in this game is a bad thing in almost every sense of the word. I don't think there's very, I can't really think of anything where a larger base is a good idea. So yeah, the base sizes of cav models cause a lot of problems.
Yeah, and so and I'll go on and I'll let me expand on that a little bit. Because the what the base size does is it creates a rather historical disadvantage that cavalry has when they charge a shield wall. And Rainier, you talked about this too. So what ends up happening is if you're in a situation where someone has anchored the flank of their shield wall, which is the proper thing to do against cavalry, so the cavalry cannot wrap around it. The constraint that the cavalry runs into is that they can no longer fight one figure on one figure, which is the way they are truly devastating. Cavalry is devastating when it's fighting one on one against infantry and it's charging. When cavalry has to charge a shield wall on a limited frontage and is basically going in against two guys on foot, who are probably backed up by two more guys with spears, or God forbid, four more guys with pikes. Your 2-to-1 dice advantage goes down to a 2-to-4 disadvantage. And cavalry can die really quickly with that. So that is that base size and that dynamic, if you are constrained in where your charge goes in, and that shield wall has nice anchored flanks, or if it's if it doesn't have anchored flanks and it's in square, right, or some sort of right angle or some sort of arc where you cannot get around the shield wall with enough space, and you're constrained to kind of go in against two guys and two guys at the least, or if the other if you're moving first and the other guy's moving second, then you're going to be fighting four guys. That is a losing proposition for any cavalry army. So that is a weakness. So I can think of at least one more
I think I can think of
detriment,
one
but
too.
Rainier, yeah, why don't you
Yeah,
throw one in here?
low fight value. I think this is what really put the Rohan Legionary Legion, like, or I think it's the Odin Legion, like above and above is like the ability to make the warriors fight four. I find myself, unless you're talking about Mahud that has its special ability to just kill models in the move phase, a fight three, I guess, or even fight two when you're talking about orcs. Cav army doesn't do too much. Well, it can do a lot, but you can't really rely on it to do too much against what you typically see at competitive events, which are fight four or above armies. So like one of those sneakers, I guess, would say like low fight value cav can kind of struggle to do that kind of punch and killing power.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'd say that a little differently because in general, cav armies tend to have higher fight value than their infantry counterparts. I mean, I don't think there's any fight two cav. There, the warg riders or whatever are fight three, and Easterlings are fight three, unless you're gonna soup them up some way with black dragons or an emperor. But in general, you have higher fight value. But with that said, if you run into infantry with a higher fight value, you've got a problem. In particular, if you run into a shield wall, charging a shield wall with a higher fight value is just suicidal. Because the number of dice, because of the big base sizes, the number of dice that get involved in cavalry fights tends to escalate quickly to the point where like you're rolling two with a banner reroll and he's rolling four with a banner reroll, and the odds of somebody rolling that six get up pretty high. And if he's out fighting you, that cavalry will die quickly. Devin, you got another one?
I mean, once again, you'd probably end up going down a caveat of different various, like, weaknesses to magic or certain types of magic anyway. Or certain types of, you mentioned monsters, Rainier, sort of in a generalistic fashion. I don't know how much down the rabbit hole we want to go. I find that once you get past the psychological, cavalry, and just from a psychological perspective, I mean, cavalry really get held down. You can force a cavalry army's hand by charging their general or specific key heroes. So, like, if you, for example, Rohan's kiting around, wants to run around and figure out where it wants to fight, just by doing one well-played heroic march and being within charge range of, like, gambling, something simple like that, not even a, but just some sort of key hero they're going to want to protect, you can force the cav army to engage. Whereas an infantry army really isn't required to do that. Cav armies will go back, and they'll have to go back kind of with their full force to do it. And so you can do that if you just shoot a general, like, let's say, cav army's moving around with all their mobility, and then suddenly you shoot Rivendell off, I mean, Elrond off his horse in a Rivendell Knight's army. Well, they're probably not going to go 10 inches anymore. And so, or at least they'll do it within their little bubble. So I think it is easy to pin down the mobility aspect if you don't protect your key targets.
Yeah, and especially too, like knowing back to like what Matt said, how expensive they are. You get a lucky shot off a horse of a general of like a leader like that. That's gonna go a long way. And I know even like at Alistair's tournament, because we referenced it earlier, I played against Khan with Dunlendings. And I knew playing against Khan, he's gonna think he can just shoot me to pieces, and I have like four Dunlendings in like a little building that have like a barrier, and like he kills one Dunlending, I kill one Khandish horseman. Like he's gonna feel it more than I'm gonna feel it, if that makes sense. So it's like that's that kind of like idea that like you lose one model and it really you feel it because they're so expensive.
But it's just the way the fact that one model is pinning the entire army down. It's just very, very annoying, like, way you can play against them.
Yeah, I mean that there's nothing more annoying when you're playing a cavalry army to have like your general's horse shot out from under him when you're still like 80, 18 inches away from the enemy. And like the rest of your cavalry, is like goes galloping off without him, and he's like Richard the Third, my kingdom for a horse. It's left behind. He's basically out of the game at that point. That is an issue. So I'll throw another one out there. I think I actually have two more things, but I'll throw another one out there, and that's terrain, right? Cavalry just cannot deal with terrain. Because unlike infantry that just kind of like goes half speed when it goes through terrain, cavalry goes a quarter speed and it loses all of the bonuses it gets otherwise. So it basically becomes infantry that moves slower than infantry. And still has the enormous base size when it goes through terrain, and that causes some problems. I mean, it's a good way if you're an infantry army to counter cavalry is, you can either deploy within it or you can anchor a flank on it, and that forces the cavalry to either go take the long way around all of that terrain to get at you from behind or charge you frontally, neither of which is really a good option for them. All right, so I've got one more in my head, but I want to flip it back to Rhaenyra
Terrain was a
Devon.
big one I was gonna say. I mean, I just hate it.
Rhaenyra Devon, you got any other ideas here?
I think that's just all like the strength of Cav use it against them.
I mean, I
Like
always hate to say all the basics, mostly because I feel like a lot of players are gonna end up knowing that. So I generally stay away from more obvious ones. So
Okay, stay away. All
outside
right.
the obvious,
All right. I'll give you another one that may
like,
be obvious, maybe not. And that's cavalry. Yeah. So the historical aphorism is cavalry cannot hold ground. And that is true in this game too. Cavalry depends on movement and it depends on getting priority to get all of its bonuses. And
heroic move, really.
yeah,
I actually
and
have a good example of
that
that
means
too.
heroic moves. And cavalry needs to spend a lot, mu much more of its resources on calling heroic moves than infantry armies do. Infantry armies can just sit there in their shield wall and grind. Cavalry armies cannot do that. Once they go in, they have to be calling heroic moves every turn to try and get that charge bonus. Sometimes they'll go off, sometimes they won't, but they have to be at least trying. And they can
Yeah.
drain through their might very quickly that way.
So you do need like a hero to support these cav armies, like good spread out. But I think one movement, like kind of you kind of alluded to it also, like objectives, you don't want to just throw your cav on the objectives and wait for your opponent to come join them. You constantly have to be hovering around the objective because you want the initiative. You know your opponent's going to come to the objective, but you're just hovering around it,
Yeah.
6 inches away, 6 inches away, and then you attack last round or last two rounds. But you're not going to, in the traditional sense, which I do see a lot of people do, throw their cav on an objective and try to hold it. Like that's not the cav's role. You're just going to like go kill the cav. You have to maneuver around it and be strategic on when to strike.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that's, the key thing is if you are within it, once your cav gets within six, if you have a cav army, once your cav gets within 6 inches of enemy infantry, you will be calling heroic moves every turn. At least every turn you don't have priority, or every turn the other guy's not challenging it. Because if you don't, you're going to be fighting an infantry fight with against twice as many infantry as you have. So, all right. So, any other thoughts, any other downsides of cavalry armies before maybe we can kind of talk cavalry tactics?
Is that without going into more basics or the very, very extreme nuances of black riders and the disadvantages
All
that
right.
this has
So,
been.
fair enough. All right. So, why don't we talk cavalry tactics? I don't know, Rainier, you use cav armies a lot. So,
I
throw out one of
do.
your cav, one of your favorite cavalry tactics, and or kind of basic how to use cavalry advice.
I think it's a lot of what we talked about, the do's and the don'ts, the weaknesses and the strengths of it. Don't hit a shield wall that you can't win in one round. You know what I mean? But what I like to do with cav is I like a lot of divergent type strategies. Put one or two to the side, like threaten an objective and kind of force your opponent to bring a whole half warband to kind of like meet them or like potentially meet. So that's what I like doing a cav strategy is play the objectives well and throw make your opponent get off guard and like have to like chase your cav and stuff like that because they will find it threatening. That's a simple one, I guess.
I mean, it's really kind of difficult to articulate cavalry tactics because it changes turn by turn depending on terrain, the army types. It changes so drastically. I mean, I guess as far as a basic one I can even think of is when you commit, you almost have to have sort of this rear guard, or at least when I've played all cav armies, you almost have this like rear guard that like counters, like so. You send them in there and everyone's bounced off each other. Well, you need some cav sitting back. So if you lose priority, you lose the heroic move off, you can then counter their charge. So they run into you and then you charge back into them and start clearing off these models that have hit you off on the side. So this is especially true. I do this a lot with like Mahud cavalry, the camels, because when you create, like, except with them, you create openings. So you create all these little pockets of openings. So that way people want to, surround my camels, charge in, and then I just charge through all the openings and start mowing them down. Of course, I get impact hits, but with, you don't want to do that necessarily with a typical cav army, but you get the kind of general ideas. You can create like multiple charge waves, I guess you can say. That's something that I've seen, and it also kind of gives a functional use to cav that normally would have been stuck waiting their turn. If you do lose priority and they engage and all that. So that's kind of a general way to play cav, is that to have that secondary charge ready to go. That, like, assuming your front wave has been.
I would totally agree with you because a lot of times you see people double line cav, kind of like a battle line, and that's a huge no, don't do that.
Well, yes,
Well,
when you say
sometimes you
double line
can.
cav, what do you mean? Like fighting them
I
two
mean,
ranks
there's
deep
like,
or?
yeah, two ranks deep, And it's kind of like it gives the opponent the opportunity to, what Devin kind of alluded, what you said, kill you and then win initiative and like kill the second rank. Whereas even if you don't play Mahood, if you spread them out, you could have a charge, not kill all the models, even have a potential like loss of a lot of your models. But then the next round, the opponent can't charge your reserves and you have always
You always
the
have to
double attack.
charge. So, I mean, to go with what both of you are saying, it is a for cavalry, it is a valid strategy to have multiple lines. When you have the multiple lines, they do not, it's not like a shield, it's not like an infantry shield wall where they're like one behind the other. The second line of the cavalry is somewhere between 6 to 8 inches behind the first line of the cavalry. And its job, as Devin said, is to, if the first line goes in, it's going to fight. And then if that first line loses priority the next turn and ends up like getting surrounded by a bunch of infantry running around behind them, that's the role of the second line of the cavalry to come in and rescue the first, to hit, come in behind the infantry and get one-on-one attacks on those infantry and hopefully knock them into the ground and help protect the first if the first can't get out. But that's kind of the role of cavalry reserve. And if you're gonna do that, I don't think you need I don't think it's two equal lines, right? I think you're probably sending like two-thirds of your cavalry in first and then keeping a third in reserve to do that function. And but that is that's a real tactic. But the thing I wanted to talk about is the timing of the charge, right? Because it is so important that your initial charge goes in on a turn when you lose priority. And the reason is that if you are charging in against somebody when you have one priority, you're moving first, you're going to go in, you're going to have and especially this is especially true if you're going in against a shield wall. You're going to go in, you're going to have your cavalry hit like one guy. So he's fighting one guy and a spear behind him. If your opponent then has the ability to move second, he takes the guy that's standing next to that one guy you hit and he moves in too. So all of a sudden you're now fighting, you've gone from fighting two dice to fighting four dice. Which is why it is incredibly critical to go in on a turn when you have lost priority, but the enemy is still within charge range. And so much of cavalry army tactics are getting your opponent into, kind of there's this magical zone that is between, that is about 6 1/4 inches away from where your cavalry line is somewhere between 6 1/4 inches away from the enemy and 10 inches away from the enemy. Assuming they're infantry, cavalry, that doesn't matter as nearly as much. But if you're fighting infantry, that is the sweet spot. You want to be when you're rolling priority between 6.5 inches and 10 inches away from the enemy. If you're within 6 inches, then he can charge you. You're too close. He can charge you, and if you don't go first, you're going to get bowled over by that infantry line. If you're outside of 10 inches, then if you you've got a dilemma if you end up moving first. If you get within 10 inches where he can, if you get within 10 inches of him where you can charge him next turn, he still hasn't moved. He can then move up right in your face, and be 4 inches away from you, which is, he can jump on you the next round. So you need to, if you don't get within 10 inches, he can just hang back and stay out of your range. So it's a real dilemma. And a lot of the tactics in cavalry fights are, how do you make sure that at the start of the round, your cavalry is between 6.5 and 10 inches away from his infantry, which is the sweet spot of where you want to be.
I think in the event that you have to charge first, because there are some scenario situations where, like everything Matt said is true. Yeah, you want to wait for ideally you lost priority, but there are cases where it just makes too much sense to maybe pin their ranks in place for some reason, or maybe they're just set up so poorly that you just kind of have to take a chance. The one, I guess, advantage of having larger bases is you can play blocking games on the flanks and stuff to at least make it where you're mitigating sort of how they're surrounding you and such, with relatively few models. Let's say you want to block off a large area, just throw a cav against like two models pretty easily. And they can create large blockage barriers. But one reason, I guess, to do that is if they're heroes for some reason, or like a lot of times if you have shooting cav armies, the tendency is to want to put the heroes in the back ranks and to protect them from the bow fire. Well, if you charge first, they don't have time to put the heroes back into the front sometimes. And I've seen scenarios where you end up like just putting these enemy heroes, like they're just kind of waiting their turn behind enemy lines. An expert player won't let that happen, but there are a lot of like kind of intermediate players who will end up having it where it's like Dane suddenly can't get into the fight because all of his guys are trapped in there. So there are some scenarios where engaging first, and that's just one that I thought of at the top of my head because it happened at the tournament that I last played at Matt's tournament. But that just to say, like, don't assume you should never charge in first. But yes, ideally when you have priority. I have
Yeah.
lost priority.
So, yeah. So, I mean, there are times when you're going to have to do it, right? And, like, one of those times is like if the enemy is within 6 inches of you, you have to go first because you have to get that charge bonus. And you
Well, I think
don't.
when once you're engaged in, then yes, you're always going to want to go
But
first.
even so, if if you've kind of and sometimes this can just happen with like bad priority dice and the way things end up, where if his shield wall closes within 6 inches of you at the end of the turn before, and then priority comes up and he's within charge range of you and you're dicing for priority, you need to go first. So if you win priority, you got to charge or you got to run away. I mean, you can also run away if you want, but what's probably going to happen is he's going to call a heroic, and then you're going to call a heroic. And unless you have a chance to do a heroic run away, what may end up happening is you may end up having to charge. Something else to think about is this dynamic of trying to the way to kind of get into that magical 6.5 inch to 10 inch zone with cavalry is to have the enemy be advancing on you while you were stationary. Because, eventually you can get to the point where if he continues to advance, he's going to get into that magical zone because he's got to cross it at some point. And the way to make him do that is if your cavalry have bows. And this is the huge advantage to the cavalry army with bows. So the Rivendell Knights, the Rohan, the Harad, and even the Mahud can do this with their blowpipes. Because you can put yourself in a position, basically you can it solves the problem of the infantry, you putting yourself kind of outside the range where the infantry can get in and charge you. Because you don't want him to like walk forward and get within charge range of you the next turn. And then he's like, okay, fine, I'm just going to stay back here and we'll see how the priority dice go the next time. If you have bows, he can't do that. Or at least if you have more bows than he does, he can't do that because you'll just shoot him down and wait for the opportunity the next time. If you have cavalry with bows, he has to come after you. Once he comes after you, it is much easier to get him in that sweet spot outside the infantry charge range and inside the cavalry charge range.
I mean, as for the kind of like the core basics of cavalry, that's really going to be how you use. I mean, I guess we go in through there are a lot of different circumstances of like terrain and magic, and that's where this game kind of gets a little tough for a cav army is like you really have to be good at adjusting to all these different variables and monsters and whatnot. So I don't know how deep you want to go down that rabbit's nest.
So I guess I'll talk about two other general cavalry tactics that folks who play cavalry armies should know. One is going for the flank. And we discussed it a bit when we talked about, wrapping around the flank of a shield wall. One of the things that mobility gives you, and you can, you know, if you can, if you've got somebody you can call a march with your cavalry, this is something to do, is with 15 inches of move, you can go from being, you know, and you know, if there isn't terrain inhibiting you, you can go from being in front of somebody's shield wall, where, you know, you're facing like a 12 man wide shield wall with your, you know, 10 cavalry guys, to on the flank of the shield wall. And you can, you know, basically position yourself. Think of it as like crossing the T, right? You know, the up and down of the T is the enemy shield wall, and then you end up being the top with your cavalry. And the advantage getting yourself into that position has is that even if, you know, even if the front, you know, even if the two guys on the end of the shield wall, or maybe the four guys on the end of the shield wall, are within 6 inches of your cavalry, who cares? Because even if you lose priority at that point, if he charges you, you know, he pins down two of your cav, the rest of the infantry lags around behind, and then your cavalry kind of sweeps in and gets the one-on-one attacks when it comes, if you can, or when it comes within range. If you can get in a position where your cavalry is on the flank of a shield wall, you no longer care about that, you know, that 6 to 10 inch sweet spot, or at least that sweet spot gets larger, because the guys at the other end of the shield wall at the back aren't going to be able to charge you. It's only the guys at the front, and you can kind of envelop both of them. So lapping around the flank is one tactic. And shoot, what was the other one? I don't know. Somebody else come up with a tactic here while I try and remember what the other one was that I was thinking of that I wanted to talk about.
Well,
So I think, oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry. I like sometimes, I don't use it always, and I wouldn't suggest it to use it always, but I like, if I have a lot of might on my heroes, I like the idea of rogue combating away, running into a battle line, rogue combating, killing two guys, and just running back away 10 inches.
Yeah.
I've used that a lot with Soledan, with my, I guess, Corsair army. I've used it also with Soledan and like yeah, just something like that, or like running him into a hero, rogue combating with one and rogue striking with the other one, knowing that your opponent can't rogue strike back, kill like a low grade hero and then just retreat back. It's kind of like, I see it like a game of chess where you're willing to sacrifice like a little bit of your resources, let's say a pawn, which represents a might point or something like that, just to tactfully break, like get closer to breaking your opponent. I know, again, I do this when I go up against like heavy armored troops or something like that. If I were to go up against like 20 something dwarves, I have Mahood. Why not just rogue combat a couple times, kill four, and run away with like two kings? So that's an odd tactic. I wouldn't suggest it always, but I've used that.
I mean, sometimes it's not even a waste of resources if, like, say you have gambling in a Rohan army, or you're just, you know, doing some kind of crazy alliance with Elendil and try to, but more accurately, probably you know, some useless captain in Maharad, or you know, yeah, gambling or whatnot, then yeah, I can see that tactic going. Like, it's just a net win every time, and you're saving whatever hero. Maybe you're doing that with Théoden, let's just say, and you really don't want to commit him to the front for some reason. But you know, so, but yeah, I mean, the what I think we should do, and maybe in a future episode, is talk about a more specific type of cav army, or at least cav armies in specific scenarios. Because imagine if the subject, even cav, is broad enough where it's not like saying you're playing with an old monster army or something. Like, it's like us almost trying to analyze what are the pros and cons and tactics of an infantry army. And it's kind of like, I mean, I guess you could talk about it, but there's just a lot going on there, which is why these discussions are a little easier if we were to say how to play Rohan and then focus very specifically on Rohan is good and bad at. Because I guess for me, my mind is still on the whole, like, I don't even know where to begin. It's like,
Where do we end this topic? I'm like, we have a
It
3-hour
complicates
podcast.
things because each faction cav army, you look at Rohan, it's completely different than like a fiefdom heavy cav army, than a Warg Marauder army, than a Corsair Serpent Riders army. Yeah,
Like each
well,
one I
all
would
right.
play
Some of
against
them
them.
aren't really true cav armies, more like gimmicks, but even if we just stick to the cav armies that are actually competitive, the four or five that exist are wildly different from each other.
But okay, let me push you back. Let me push back on that. Are they really? I mean, so
I mean, we can name them.
is there any situation, you know, is there any cavalry army
Yeah.
where the concept of outflanking in the open flank of a shield wall is a bad idea? Is there any cavalry army that can't, if it pulls that off, succeed?
I mean, infantry want to do the same and outflank an army and whatnot.
Yeah,
They're
but every cavalry army is going to move 10 inches or more. Every
they
cavalry
are just
army
certainly
can get
more
somebody
effective
that.
at doing it. But I mean, if you're
Yeah.
playing Lurts of Scouts, then we're having the same conversation.
Yeah,
It's a fast-moving model.
maybe
It's
we
just
are. Maybe we are.
capable.
But we're talking about cavalry armies, and it, you know, the I guess
Yeah.
the point I'm trying to make is every cavalry army
Has to
can,
do
if you
it.
have a mounted captain, and all of them can get mounted captains, can like move their cavalry 15 inches on a given turn. You know, and if somebody has let, you know, has created a big long shield wall and left their flank open, or they, you know, they have not anchored their flank on terrain or other cavalry, every cavalry can be, or every infantry army can be outflanked like that. Every cavalry army can do this to an infantry army. And I mean, that's what I'm trying to get at, is I'm trying to get at strategies here that, yeah, there are going to be some armies that can do it better than other armies can, but every cavalry army can use these tactics.
Yes, and certainly true. You're not wrong. I don't know if outflanking 100% is unique to them so much as, like, let's say, the cav bonuses that they get or the base sizes that they are, burdened with. But yeah, I know. I mean, I get it, and you're not wrong. I would wonder if it would be easier to give thoughts. You're right, though. I mean, everything so far that we've given is unique to Cav for the most part. I mean, so you're certainly not wrong on that. So I would think that it'd be a little easier to give tactical advice. Usually when I think of tactical, I'm almost like you are talking about very specific circumstances, and here's how we exploit that, or here's how we get away from that, which we think we've done a good job on so far. But now we're starting to get into, like, okay, what about the variables? And that's kind of tough to describe when we have such a wide plethora of options still out
All
there.
right. Well,
Yeah, just my thought anyway.
fair enough. We've got a few minutes left here. Why don't we talk for a little bit about countering cavalry armies? And let's make some assumptions here. We don't need to talk about like how monsters counter cavalry armies, because we've talked about that. Let's just assume you've got an infantry army and you're facing a cavalry army.
Do you want me to recap the ones we've covered? Because there's more than just the monsters. We've covered shooting out the generals or key targets so that way they're footed out. We've talked about heroic marching or drumming to close that 10-inch gap that you just
Battle
discussed
lines of
earlier.
quarters. Yep, fair enough.
Yeah. And we did discuss, which is then compounded with pinning them down,
Yep.
actually engaging the key hero. Terrain, we kind of talked about basically.
Yeah, so let's talk about that in more
Okay.
detail. We have talked about that, but let's talk about that in more detail so that people know what we're talking about here. And because we at least I've been throwing around the term anchoring flanks, and I want to make sure that people understand what that means. So what it means to anchor a flank of a shield wall or a battle line is you have something there so that, I mean, infantry or cavalry can't spill around it. You know, the consequences of cavalry spilling around the flank of a shield wall are much more dire than infantry spilling around the flank of a shield wall, because the infantry can't go that far. And if it hits you, it isn't going to get double dice, and knock you down and then kill you. But when we talk about anchoring a flank, we mean, next to the end guy in the shield wall is something that prevents somebody else from lapping around that side. It can be a building. It can be terrain that slows somebody down, and in particular, terrain that slows cavalry down. Or like we were talking about earlier, you can kink your line so that you're, either forming an L or forming a square, so that if the cavalry does get around the side of the shield wall, what it hits is more shield wall. Or the other thing that can be sitting there is, a monster, a big scary monster that the cavalry doesn't want to hit, or other cavalry. But it's something on the end of that shield wall that prevents the cavalry from lapping around. And I just want to kind of talk through that concept. I think most of the people who listen to this podcast understand what anchoring a flank is, but yeah, some people out there are going to be new to the game and they may not understand that. And, I got to say, I play in a lot of games where people fail to anchor the flanks of their infantry and, something bad happens. So it's a concept to keep in mind, not just against cavalry, by the way, but against, like, say, flying monsters. It is very important to anchor the flank of a shield wall, because if a flying monster gets on the end of your shield wall and starts hurling down the length of it, that's a really big problem. So if you're facing a flying monster, you need something at each end of the shield wall, so that flying monster can't put itself there and start, bowling for infantry.
No, yeah.
I mean,
I just agree with you. Like, I think it's true. Like, for me, like, as a player, when I have a cav model, especially with might, if you don't see an anchored flank, like, that sucker's gone. And that's even, like, for protecting a caster in the back. That's protecting banners. That's protecting anything that's of importance. Like, you can really do some damage if you don't check those key concepts. And that's why I think our discussions, a lot of these things sound small when playing cav, but also when playing against cav, you have to take into consideration those small things that are more on the tactical side and historical side of common sense when it comes to strategy. Do things that you would read about in a history book. Do things that you would read about when you're reading about, like, how Alexander conquered the Persians with his cav. Like, those concepts do apply to cav and MSF in Middle Earth strategy battle game. I think that, in my opinion, is what the joy of cav is. The balance of this game is everything's kind of just historical to an extent.
Yeah. It really is. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to be stupid. I'm like, yeah, that's why I anchor against shallow pawns. Just make sure
I have all of that. Yeah, look, you're not wrong.
Cav move over to, like, clear terrain. I was being
I see. All right. So that is a problem. Don't anchor on a shallow pond unless you're fighting infantry. But, if you want to anchor against deep water, that works just fine.
Deep water, yeah.
Yeah.
No, they I think they get a +1 on the swim chart, but still the idea is there, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think you can swim into combat, can you?
I don't know. No, you can fight in water. You could actually be in close combat and fight in water. So
while you're swimming.
Yeah, because it's just in the movement phase. Right. You just have to take a swim test. But
I thought in the new edition, though, if you took one of those tests, you couldn't actually enter combat unless you got a 6. That is a swim an exception to that?
Well, no, you're referencing something that I personally don't remember. So
that swimming. I know it is true on, like, a climb or jump test, right? Mm. You can't jump into somebody's control zone. You can't climb into somebody's control zone unless you roll the 6, or you're on a ladder or something like that.
Why you stand a millimeter away from all barriers?
Yeah. All right, let's not open that can of worms. But what I can't remember is whether you can swim into combat. But we digress.
Yeah.
Because you're right. A shallow pond is not a good thing to anchor on
Though it
if
would be
you're
an
trying to anchor
interesting
against
way to
cavalry.
anchor your cav army against infantry if for some reason you wanted to limit that in some way. But like using shallow water, which is actually cavalry, is the one reason, like the Anduin River at Nova, we like put that all the way to the bottom because we're like cav armies just crush people in that.
Yeah, so that is kind of one weird thing about, and I'm not, as we've discussed, in most circumstances, the way this rule kind of handles stuff produces historical results. I'm not sure the massive advantage that cavalry gets in shallow water is one of them. So just so you know, shallow water normally counts as difficult ground to infantry, so infantry half moves. Cavalry ignores it. So cavalry can go at full speed through shallow water. They get all their charge bonuses, yada, yada. And if they catch infantry in shallow water and they knock them down, then the infantry is on the ground and they need to make a swim test before they stand up or they drown. Which if they have like heavy armor, you get penalties for having heavy armor, you
Oh,
get penalties for
dwarves do not want
shields.
to do
Yeah,
it.
exactly. Which I guess is something that's worth talking about. Cavalry is devastating to an opponent that is in shallow water. Or at least an infantry opponent that is in shallow water. So that is something to think about. If you are cavalry and you can catch an infantry in shallow water in like a river or a stream or a pond or something like that, go for it because there's nothing worse than having somebody's like general drown. Because he rolled a one and didn't have the might to get it up. He was wearing heavy armor and had a shield and rolled a one, didn't have the might to survive. He's just, no fate, no nothing. He's just gone.
Yeah.
So.
For anyone who finds that weird, I imagine in the game they're thinking all shallow water that'll actually impede movement or be worth even thinking about is gotta be like 3 feet high. So that's the only way I could imagine you drown
Yeah. Well,
in like
look, I
a
mean,
horse is holding you down or something.
Well, look, I mean, plenty of infantrymen in history have drowned in shallow water, or been trampled in shallow water, or pressed down and drowned in shallow water. So that happens. The fact that cavalry can, what really gives cavalry kind of the huge advantage is because, they're like Jesus walking on the shallow water. Because typically, horses going through shallow water would step on rocks and turn their hooves and break legs and fall and stuff like that, and or they get mired in mud or all this
They
other
actually
stuff.
should move like half speed.
Well, it kind of depends on the shallow water, right? Because if there's like just sand on the bottom, they'd probably you're right they probably would just pass right through it, right? But they have there isn't any of those gradations of like what's underneath the shallow water to throw in there. It's just all like all sh you know, shallow water is like the shallow end of a swimming pool.
Yeah.
So that's a place that cavalry like because they're big and they're tall and they can step through it with ease. So,
Right.
yeah. All
Well,
right, guys.
we'll do more specific episodes in the future, I suppose, but
I mean, maybe it's time to start going back to the armies and start going back to the armies and start talking like tactics with the different armies. That's actually sounds like it'd be an
yeah,
interesting set of
we
episodes.
might consider that instead of just going over the profiles and a quick tactic, like maybe just a pure episode on tactics for each
Yeah.
faction.
Yeah, no,
In
that makes sense.
true form, actually, I know you used to, well, I forget who introduced him, but the episodes where we would say like changes we would make to the game. I wonder if you
Yep.
just a whole episode of changes you make to cavalry to make them like historically accurate yet still fun. I
Yeah,
don't know.
well, I mean, I have to say,
It's pretty accurate.
as skirmish games go, this captures it pretty well. I'm not sure that I've played another skirmish game that kind of captures it.
Even the historical ones?
Even the historical ones that captures it in as simple a way and fun way as this one does. I mean, this game has a bunch of simple cavalry mechanics that are really just extrapolations of the way infantry works with some bells and whistles added on. And the way it works out, like I said, real cavalry tactics will work. right? Running around the flank, like I said, running around the flank of a shield wall and, coming in and hitting it from front and back simultaneously or lapping around the flank, that is a real historical cavalry tactic. Having a second line of cavalry behind the first, so the first goes in and does an initial charge, and then the second line comes in to extract it, that is a real historical tactic. That is how Napoleonic cavalry operated. They fought in two lines, the first line would charge, and then as it was disengaging, the second line would charge to cover the withdrawal of the first line. That's how they operate. And there's a lot of these that really, the cavalry tactics on the table work historically.
That's pretty good then. All right.
So,
Then I didn't realize it was that accurate.
All right. Well, anyway, that's cavalry tactics. Maybe next time we'll start talking about some army-specific tactics. That sounds fun.
Yeah. All right.
All
I'll
right.
talk to you guys soon then.
Take care, everybody.
Take care.